Welcome to the Sustainable Ag Writer Podcast, a podcast bringing you news and views about sustainable agriculture from across the southeastern United States. Every show will feature insightful interviews and deep dives into sustainable agriculture topics with farmers, ranchers, land-grant universities, and local food system advocates. Now, here's your host, Brennan Washington.
Welcome, welcome, welcome. How's everybody doing today? How you doing? This is it. This is the first episode of the Sustainable Ag Writer Podcast, and I'm so glad you decided to download and listen to me. I've been working on this podcast for quite some time. It's been an idea of mine that came to me as a result of doing my work around the Southeast, and I was looking for a vehicle that would help tell the stories of the people that I meet, to help share ideas, and to just tell the story of the small-scale farmers that often get overlooked when we hear discussions about farmers. I don't know what I'm doing with this show yet, y'all. So the planned format, at least for now, is that we're going to pick a subject. So let's talk about, first of all, what is sustainable agriculture? And for the purposes of this show, we're always going to view sustainable agriculture as a three-legged stool. The first leg of the stool is environmental, that we're farming in an environmentally conscious way that not only preserves and protects our soils and watersheds and other things in our environment, but also helps to rebuild it. So that's the one leg of the stool, the environmental piece. The second piece is one that I really care a lot about, and that's the financial leg. And the financial leg deals with making sure, in a nutshell, that farmers are viable, that not only are they running their farms and that not only are they making money, but they're making money in a manner that allows them to sustain their families and to keep their family farm going. So that's the financial leg. And that this farming is not being done in a financially exploitive fashion, that the agriculture that's done in the name of sustainability actually values labor, actually values workers, and actually values the efforts of the farmers themselves. So that's the second leg of the stool. The third leg is the social leg, social sustainability. Are we building communities that are going to be and farming in a way that's going to result in healthy, vibrant communities where we're not having situations where we can go through small town after small town after small town and they have no job opportunities? They have no access to fresh, healthy foods, but yet they're surrounded by agriculture. So those are the three legs of the stool, and each show will take on one or more of those legs of the stool. So today, for example, we're going to be speaking with Carol Williams, the new executive director of Southern Sog, and we're just going to be having a general question about sustainability. So it sort of may touch on all three of those legs. Our next episode with Scott Marlowe is small-scale agriculture, how healthy is it? We're going to be touching more on that financial leg. So that's how you should view this going into the show, is we are going to take up one or more of those legs of sustainability. So in terms of format, there'll be one or two interviews per show with someone involved in sustainable and small-scale agriculture. Now, this show is going to have a very heavy emphasis on the southeastern United States because that's where I do a lot of my work with. But the topics and the subjects that will be covered on this show are probably applicable anywhere. It may be a little bit different in your areas in terms of geographic stuff, but soil health is soil health no matter where you go in the country. So we're going to have one or two interviews, and then I'm going to do an opening segment that leads us into the primary discussion we're going to have with our guest. And that's it. And so hopefully, you know, I'm going to be making some mistakes. I've got some work to do on my delivery. I'm not used to talking behind a microphone. Anybody who knows me knows I'm pretty good when I'm in front of a crowd or if I'm talking to you person to person. So it's been a lot for me to get adjusted to talking into a microphone. So having said that, today on this number one show, I want to talk about an article that I read actually just this morning. And the name of the article is 5 Myths About Rural America That Muddle the Political Realities. And the other thing you should realize that this show is going to do is we're going to cover a lot about rural America. My farm, Phoenix Gardens, is considered an urban ag operation, and I've been a huge proponent of urban agriculture for the past almost 20 years. But it is what it is. If we're going to talk about changing the dynamics of our food system, if we're going to talk about improving communities around the country, if we're going to talk about having major stays in who grows our food and how they grow that food, then we need to be talking about rural communities. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. So there's going to be a heavy rural skew. We're also going to do shows on urban ag and topics that are applicable across the entire landscape. But rural communities and rural agriculture is going to get a lot of play on this show because that's where the money is, as I forget what the background name used to say. Anyway, this article in the Washington Post by a gentleman named Christopher Ingraham talks about five myths about rural America and how it's affecting things in our political discourse. I also think it even affects things going down into policy and stuff like that. And I'm not going to go over all five. There's three that I really want to cover before we get started with our conversation with Carol. So I'll just read a little bit of what he said. Myth number one, rural is synonymous with Midwestern. Earlier this year, New York Times politics editor Jonathan Weissman provided a particularly clumsy example of this common conflation, suggesting that U.S. Representatives Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib, Omar from Minnesota and Tlaib from Michigan, who represent densely populated urban districts in their state, weren't really Midwestern. Now, keep that in mind. One's from Minnesota and one's from Michigan, which are definitely considered Midwestern states, but he said that they weren't really Midwestern. He goes on to say, this is nonsense, of course. The Midwest is a region, not a population density. He's absolutely right. But it starts to show you that there's this mythical ethos up there, especially around agriculture and, especially around rural communities, which then bleeds itself into the world of agriculture. And that's this a notion that not only are rural communities dominated by what you find in the Midwest, but so is a lot of agriculture. And unfortunately, as you'll hear a little bit today, and especially in the interview with Scott Marlowe, that bleeds over into things like USDA policy and to even things like some of the federal policies on disaster relief that we've been seeing. So that's myth number one. Myth number two, rural is synonymous with white. I cannot agree more that this misperception exists out there in the world, and that is absolutely false. But time and time and time after again, when we see discussions about rural America, it typically only involves white citizens from those communities. What about Jackson, Mississippi? What about Greenville, South Carolina? What about Henderson, North Carolina? What about Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and the areas surrounding that? I can go on and on and on. What about McAllen, Texas, and the Rio Grande Valley, which has one of the largest base of Hispanic farmers in the United States? Those are rural communities. I've been there, but you never hear them. You never see them on TV. Think about all the commercials you see, the Farm Fresh commercials, when they want to give this perception that your food is coming from a nice, wholesome, all-American family farm. Think about those commercials. I'm sure you could think one or two of them, some of the dairy commercials and stuff like that. Now think about how many of those involve farmers of color. And I know farmers of color are out there. So there, once again, it skews into this perception that there's these monolithic blocks within our country when it comes to geographic determinations. And he goes on to say, one of the most regrettable Trump-era trends in political reporting is the diner safari, in which a big city reporter is parachuted into a small town in the middle of the country in search of the secret wisdom of diner patrons in overalls and trucker caps. First, I'm going to take a little bit of issue with him at that. This did not start with Donald Trump. I can remember during the Obama era, we saw that same thing. During the Bush era, we saw that same thing. If anything, it may have become more pronounced and aggravated during this current presidency. But I think it's misleading to say that or to allege that this sort of started with him, because it didn't. And to do so really minimized what the overall problem is. He goes on to say the unfortunate effect of such stories is that they don't reflect the fact that a fairly large and growing share of rural Americans are in fact non-white, about 22% as of 2018, or more than 10 million people. And he's right. I mean, that's what I do in my work, is just travel around, at least in the Southeast, to all of these predominantly rural communities where you find a lot of people of color. And they may have different political beliefs than their white counterparts in some of these rural communities. And not surprisingly, some of their religious beliefs, as far as being a lot more conservative than the general population, they probably parallel each other on many issues. But that's an article we're going to be looking at a lot of. And going back to this, what this guy said about this being a Trump-era trend, Don Cooper, a good friend of mine who used to run the Georgia Organics Farmer Mentoring Program and now does a podcast called Stricoline, he's just talking with another country guy, country farm, and they just cover a whole bunch of subjects. But he was talking about an article, and I have not read this New York Times article. I'm going to try and find it so I can read it. But this was after Hurricane Michael. So for those of you who don't know, you know, we've heard a lot about how Florida got hit by Hurricane Michael and other parts of the country got hit and how the devastation was so damaging, which it was. But no one hardly talks about Southwest Georgia. Southwest Georgia is one of the premier agricultural geographic areas in our country. If you eat a peanut, if you got a jar of peanut butter in your pantry now, chances are some of those peanuts, if not all, came from Southwest Georgia. If you eat pecans, if you have pecans, you're going to make you a nice pecan pie. Chances are those pecans came from Southwest Georgia. And the numbers, and I'm doing this off the top of my head, so if anybody's listening to me, Don, if you're out there, you want to come on the show one day. But after Hurricane Michael, in Southwest Georgia, and we're not talking the entire state, we are talking just a portion of the state of Georgia, they had agricultural losses in the amount of $2.4 billion, I think the number was. So down in Southwest Georgia, they big pecan stronghold, big peanut stronghold, a lot of landowners and farmers grow timber. So pine trees for the paper that you write on, the 2x4s that you use for building projects, the pine needles that you put on your lawns to make them look pretty. Typically, that comes from the work of these farmers down in this region. There's a large chicken processing operations down there. When Michael sailed through here, through Southwest Georgia, acres and acres and acres of trees were lost. Dozens and dozens and dozens of chicken operations were lost. Not only were peanut crops lost, and if that's all it was, because you could always replant the next year, they lost all the processing. So you can rebound and grow another crop of peanuts the next year. If the weather cooperates with you and the stars align, you'll get a crop. But if you got no way to take those peanuts, to get them clean, to get them washed, to get them graded, what are you going to do with them? Really, what are you going to do with them? So, and once again, I said I'm doing this off the top of my head. So just from some of the numbers that Don shared on his podcast is pecans, I think they had like $600 million in lost trees. They lost another $200 million because a hurricane hit right when the nuts were about to be harvested. And I think they lost another $100 million or something like that. Oh, no, another $200 million and lost sales. Because think about it. Pecans are those type of crops that they come back each year. So you're predicting you don't have to replant them. You just have to harvest those nuts and process them each year. Well, you take out a farmer's 40-acre or 100-acre grove of pecan trees, and he was counting on, I don't even know what the economics behind pecans are, but let's say he made $100,000 off of those pecans every year, and his stand is relatively new, maybe 20, 25 years old, which is young for pecans. And he's counting on getting, at a minimum, let's say another 10 years out of that stand that he has. Well, that's gone now. That's gone. So that income is gone, and what's that farmer going to do? Timber. Once the timber's gone, it's gone. So I'm talking about those two industries specifically, because one of the things Don mentioned on his show was that he talked to a lot of people. He gets around like I do. And he talked to a lot of folks who were either up in their years, close to retirement, or, you know, maybe in the 40 or 50 range where they still had a lot of years to go. And they said they're not getting out. And I don't blame them. That's a tough decision to make because you just lost your entire pecan grove. Let's say you want to replant. You stick that tree in the ground, and I know they're coming out with some new varieties, but at a minimum, before that tree reaches full reproductive, full production, you're maybe talking about 10 years. So 10 years. So you stick a tree in the ground, and you're not getting any, you're not realizing any income from that tree for 10 years. And most people say, hey, look, I'm too old for it. And I understand that. I heard a little bit of the same thing down in Puerto Rico when it came to the coffee plantations. So I'm saying all that to say is after Hurricane Michael happened, apparently there was this article written in the New York Times. They sent a team down to cover the after effects of Hurricane Michael and what was being done and that type of stuff. So they came down, they interviewed a bunch of folks. And from everybody I talked to, the general slant of the article when it was finally written was, and this is in a nutshell, Hurricane Michael. The chickens coming home to roost for conservative climate change deniers. I'm pretty sure the article didn't exactly say that, but a lot of people felt that that was the thrust of the article. And in there, that article, from what everybody said, carries the seeds of a lot of stuff that we have wrong with our rural communities. First of all, they assumed that these communities in Southwest Georgia are overall monolithically white, and they're not. Mrs. Shirley Sherrod and her husband, Charles Sherrod, their operation is down there. And they work with a lot of black farmers in that region. They're down there. Don had a line on his show. It said she's met some of the most horribly racist people that he can meet in certain areas of South Georgia. But yet when you leave their house and you walk outside, there's all these mixed race kids walking around. And, you know, they had a real chance to show the diversity and complexity of some of what really is rural America, and they didn't seize it from what everybody has told me. Once again, I did not read that article, but I've heard it from enough people whose opinions that I trust that that's the way the slant was. So we're going to be talking about stuff like this and how it intertwines with some of the larger and smaller issues that we're going to be talking about. And so what are the issues? What are we going to be covering on this show? Well, we're going to be covering a lot of stuff. We're going to be covering the hemp hype. I can't go anywhere in my 13 southeastern states without hearing about hemp. It's at the top of every conference list. If they're doing a workshop, they usually have to have it in a ballroom because 200 or 300 people are going to show up. So we're going to talk about hemp. We're going to talk about the hype. We're going to talk about the challenges. We're going to talk about the opportunities. We're going to talk about our 1890 land grant universities, which are our black land grants. We're going to talk about stuff like Southern University's Small Farm Ag Leadership Program and the impact that that program has had on black agricultural leaders in the South over the past 7 or 8 years. We're going to talk about the work of Noah S. Wick and Dr. Michelle Ealy and the work that they're doing around trying to build training and curricula to train extension personnel on how to develop culturally appropriate disaster preparedness material for farmers of color and suicide prevention. We're going to be talking a lot, not a whole lot. I don't want to depress everybody else and say, I can't listen to this guy anymore. But we are going to be talking about farmer mental health and some of the reality that's going on around some of the very, very difficult issues that farmers are facing right now. We're going to have some fun. We're going to be doing man on the street interviews from some of the upcoming conferences like Southern SOG, Georgia Organics, the Virginia Biological Association conference, all the conferences that cater to small scale farmers. We're going to be talking about veterans in farming and what that really means. And are we supporting our veterans the way we need to when they come back from a lot of times what has been a very, very traumatic experience, and then going into a field that is very challenging, and are we supporting them in the manner that we need to, and in a manner that they need and want? That's critical. We're going to be talking about medical marijuana. We're going to be talking about production, just basic production practices. We'll be talking about Small ruminants. How do you control parasites in your small ruminants? Which breeds do best in which areas? Or what are the tips for growing healthy sheep? Is there a market and why aren't more people interested in growing hair sheep and sheep for fiber? We're definitely going to be talking a lot about local food systems. Who grows our food? How they grow their food? How it gets to us? What resources do we need to put into place so that people have access to fresh food? And what do we need to do to make sure that once that access is available, that the people who are getting that food is utilizing that food in a healthy manner? You know, I always ask a question. I've been very, very active in helping to develop farmers market in the state of Georgia. And one of the major rationales for pushing out farm, well, there was a couple. One big one was that we can address the issue of food insecurity. Another one, which was a quiet one, which I didn't see until I ran a couple of markets, was that properly done, a farmer's market can really increase the life of a downtown and a small community. Because once they started building big box stores, you know, people would drive past your downtown area to go to Home Depot, go to the mall, and those downtown started to die. And people started seeing, as this emphasis on local, a more awareness of where your food came from, people saw that there were other effects to that. So when you had your farmers markets, for example, I ran a market in Lawrenceville for about 4 years, I think. And one of the things, we used to do these surveys to see what people would do when they left the market. And, you know, most people would stay downtown for a little while, and most of them would spend at least $25 to $50 during that stay. The overwhelming majority of that was doing stuff like having lunch and stuff, because that was the majority of the businesses we had in our little downtown area in Lawrenceville, which is, for those of you who want to know where Lawrenceville, we're about 18 miles north of Atlanta proper. We're right outside the perimeter, but we're 30 minutes from Hartsfield-Jackson Airport. But you know, I said, okay, this is good. We got this raw data. I don't know how true it is. And then 1 year we were growing so fast, we were starting to get vendors who needed electricity. So we had meat vendors coming in, and we had some ice cream folks to give ICs to the kids and stuff. So we just needed power. And the person who owned the site where we were didn't really want to invest in giving us any power. So the city gave us some power. So we, make a long story short, we moved that market off the square. And one of the big complaints we heard was that we were killing that Saturday afternoon business for those local businesses. So we need to talk about farmers markets and have they reached a plateau and the benefits that they offered? Are they still for all the talk about equity and for all the talk about delivering healthy food to people, is it still just a province of fairly well-to-do people, be they black or white? Is it really just an avenue and an option for people with money? Those are questions we need to ask. And that's what we're going to be doing on this show, not only looking at these issues, but really asking questions that need to be asked. And you hear Scott and I talk a lot about that in his episode. I'm a true believer when it comes to sustainable ag. You cut me, and I don't know what sustainable ag blood it looks like, but that's what will come out. I'm a true believer. But I also believe that we've dropped the ball on a lot of things. I don't believe we've asked the questions that we need to be asking as this movement. So we're going to be doing quite a few shows, going back to that financial leg of the stool, quite a few shows on, are farmers really making money out there? You know, I'm sure those of you who follow have at least come across once these stories of these young farmers. And I'm great to see, it's great to see so many young farmers deciding that this is what they want to make a vocation and the passion that they're bringing to it. But are they making any money? You know, are they working 90-hour weeks for what turns out to be less than minimum wage? And then on the same hand, making themselves sick because they don't have health insurance. We need to start having honest, deep and honest conversations about that. We're going to be covering urban agriculture. I'm a big urban ag guy. And, you know, I was at the National Outreach Conference back in September. And I was on an opening plenary session, and they just had a bunch of USDA folks and myself. And guy sitting next to me was either number two or three man with National Resource Conservation Service, NRCS. I just drawing a blank on his name right now. But anyway, he was talking about everything that NRCS had available to people who do outreach to farmers and ranchers, and then some of the new stuff that came out of the 2018 Farm Bill, one of which was funding to establish a, when I first heard it, it was called a sustainable ag, an urban ag agency, but I think it may end up being an urban ag department. But the big news was that urban ag was officially, quote unquote, enshrined as a legitimate production system within USDA. And I turned to him after, I had to speak after him, and then once he was done, he said that, I turned around, I said, you know, y'all used to throw me out of the room about 10 years ago when I talk about urban ag, and he just laughed. So just shows you the progression of this stuff, and I've seen a lot of great stuff in urban ag being done. There's a lot of good work going on out there. There's D-Town Farms up in Detroit with Malik Yakini is doing some outstanding work. We have Truly Living Well here in Atlanta. Also Global Growers here in Atlanta. We have Footprint Farms in Jackson, Mississippi. And they're doing some really, really interesting works around urban ag. But I also have issues with urban ag. I don't think urban ag has demonstrated that it's going to be a long-term, financially viable method of production. I just don't. And I don't even think that it's doing, I don't think anybody's even starting to try to measure what the impact is. And I think that's a lot of our problems outside of things like soil health and animal health and stuff like that in a sustainable ag is that a lot of times these bromides get thrown around, but we really don't take a step back to see, well, wait a minute, is this really happening? And if not, why isn't it happening? And if it's not happening, you know, what's the solution? And I don't think we do enough of that. Like, I think we've dropped the ball in sustainable ag on paying entirely too much attention on the production side and not enough on the retail end of things. That has been left to sort of find its way. It started out with CSAs. Well, CSAs are on decline across the country. And with not having a robust answer or some robust solutions to that retail space, meaning who owns that? How do we get that last? What's the deal with that last mile? That food that we're encouraging these smaller farmers to grow? How's that food getting to those people in the communities? It just can't be farmers markets, people. That's not sustainable over the long term. I don't even think it's sustainable right now. We're going to be talking about ag in the middle because that's a serious problem in this country. Ag in the middle are those mid-scale farms, you know, maybe a couple hundred acres up to 1,000 that are disappearing year by year. They're either being snapped up by, and well, in many cases, they're being snapped up by larger corporate farms and this increasing rise of investor-owned farms. But they're disappearing and their markets are disappearing. We're going to have a interesting session on the dairy industry. If you don't know anything about dairy, dairy is just dying here, getting hurt. And a lot of the news you hear about farmer suicides, a lot of it you'll hear coming out of the dairy industry because of the economic conditions that are there. And lastly, we'll be talking about some fun things. We'll talk about all of the interesting conferences that they have. We'll talk about the work that's being done in Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands. Going to have my good friend Dr. Lewis Peterson on. We'll talk about just how we can help you become a better farmer, rancher, or local food system advocate and what we need to do to make you more successful in the work that you do. So we need your info, we need your show ideas, and we hope you continue to watch. Now, like I said, I got a lot of work to do to make sure my commitment to you as a host of this show is to bring you, first and foremost, compelling content. Content that you're going to say, yeah, this is worth my while to download it off iTunes and spend an hour and 90 minutes listening it to. And I'm going to make sure, goal number two for me is to make sure that it's consistent. So I don't want to do a show today and you don't hear from me for 4 weeks. So I've got a plan where originally I was only going to go every 2 weeks. But when I started talking to people about being on the show and got a feel for how I could record people, it sort of lent itself more to a weekly show. So we'll do a weekly show. So those are my first two goals right out the back, to make sure that I deliver you compelling, interesting, and valuable content. And that I do it on a consistent basis. So I'll improve my delivery. I'll improve the pace of the show and the subjects. And I'm sure that people will give me tips. Right now, I'm going to be avoiding ads and stuff like that because I think it's more important now that as a team, we build together a resource that we want to see here before we, obviously I've got to at some point pay for this, but right now the goal is to deliver you that compelling content and to make sure I deliver it on a consistent basis. And so with that, let's go ahead and talk with Carol Williams, who is the new executive director of Southern Sock. Okay, welcome to the Sustainable Ag Writer Podcast. My special guest here is Carol Williams, who is the new executive director of the Southern Sustainable Agriculture Working Group, but all of us who've known the organization refer to it as Southern SARG. That's our loving moniker for the organization. How are you doing, Carol?
I'm real good. How about you?
Good, good. Thank you for joining me on this day after Thanksgiving, this Black Friday, I guess is what they call today now, huh?
yeah, there's that, right? Yeah, and yeah. But hey, thanks for having me. This is fantastic time of year to be sitting down and having conversations about all that we're thankful for, but all that we look forward to doing, accomplishing with regard to sustainable ag and Southern Sock.
Yes, yes, yes. So you're probably up to your eyeballs now with conference planning, huh?
Yes, that's true. That's very true.
Yeah.
And I came on at the end of June, which is typically the time when conference planning is already underway.
Mm-hmm.
So when I came on, there was a lot to learn right away.
Okay.
And some new folks have come on board to help out. So we have had the opportunity to get to know each other, to form and solidify our team, and have a fan program planned again for this year in Little Rock, or excuse me, this next conference, January 2020 in Little Rock.
Yes, yes. So I've been familiar with Southern SARG for quite some time, but for our listeners who are not familiar with the organization or not as familiar with it, can you give a little history how it started and what the goals of the organization is?
Sure. And I'm new to the organization. I mean, I had attended conferences in the recent past.
Mm-hmm.
So I was not a part of Southern SOG during its formation, but I can give everyone a little bit of background on the organization. So some forward-thinking folks back in 1991 sat down together to form an umbrella group to bring together, well, I think it was about 30 organizations across the South. So 13 states from Virginia to Florida, over to Texas and Oklahoma, and all the way up to Kentucky. So folks across that region were taking a cue from folks in the Midwest who were organizing themselves as an organization of organizations to try to help each other out, to get particularly the needs and the opportunities of the South in people's minds and awareness, because everything that was going on in other parts of the country in terms of sustainability, the needs, what folks wanted to do, what they aspired to do, and the help that they needed, whether it was regarding policy or economic barriers, knowledge and training. All those things were needed in the South too, but they're a bit different in the South than say, you know, like in Maine, for example, just even in terms of the sorts of crops and cropping systems that folks were doing at that time in the South and do now. So those folks got together to form this umbrella organization to help each other address those needs and those aspirations. There's been a little bit of evolution along the way, but the core mission remains the same. And that is to work to form a more sustainable, fair, equitable, and humane agricultural systems and food systems. So that core remains the same. And of course, as technology and policy and knowledge about crops and cropping systems change, you know, some of the specifics that Southern SOG has worked on have changed and evolved over the last 29 years. But the conference remains the core of SOG's work. So in January, this coming January, in Little Rock will be the 29th annual conference. And next year, obviously, will be 2021, will be the 30th anniversary conference. And Southern SOG has been at this for a while. Mm-hmm. And each year, between 800 and 1,200 farmers, aspiring farmers, young farmers, folks that transition from more conventional methods to more sustainable methods, folks from policy, folks from local foods, food hubs and things, convene with our conference to get training for information and exchange sessions, for policy sessions, field trips, many things very, very practical in their nature in terms of new methods, cropping systems, hoop houses, information about FSMA, the Food Safety Food Safety Modernization Act, things of that nature. And of course, a lot of partner organizations involved and various funders helping out with scholarships, for example, at farmers and trainers to the conference to be able to help spread that knowledge and information. Yes.
Well, thank you. You're an ag person. Did you come from an ag background? Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Oh, thank you. I live just outside of Augusta, Kentucky. I am the first generation from my family to not be raised on a farm.
Oh, wow.
Okay. But I have returned to the farm. So I was raised in Cincinnati, but where I live now is about 130 acres that has been in my family since 1913.
Oh, wow.
My grandfather was very typical of his generation and a son of German immigrants. Mixed farming. He used mules to pull his plow, mixed livestock, a milk cow, some hogs, kind of a subsistence living. And then, of course, raised tobacco as the cash crop, as so many people across the South did. Mm-hmm. So I was also the first, my brother and I and one cousin were the first generation in our family to go to college. I went on to study science, received my PhD.
Where'd you go to school?
I went to Southern Illinois University.
Okay.
I studied with one of the founders, the International Association of Landscape Ecologists. So technically, I was in geography and environmental science, but what I was studying is ecological processes at the scale of landscapes. I went on to do my postdoctoral research work at Iowa State University in agronomy. And I was supervised by Dr. Matt Liebman, mm-hmm. who was a co-founder of the first graduate program in sustainable agriculture in the United States. And he worked, the other person at Iowa State at the time that co-founded that program was Ricardo Salvador. And Ricardo Salvador, you might know, is a senior scientist with the Union of Concerned Scientists. Mm-hmm. So sometimes it's kind of a small world.
Yes, but, yes. Very small world.
Yeah. So I then went on to be research scientist at the University of Wisconsin and then at the Center of Agroforestry at the University of Missouri before I had the opportunity to come home to the family farm mm-hmm. and to put into practice on the land here all those things that I had been studying. And then made the leap from academia and research and science into doing and advocating. So I am absolutely honored and just very, very pleased to be in the fortunate situation that I am to be able to do those two things, to farm, put into agroforestry parts of the land on my family's farm and transition it to more sustainable practices and hopefully carbon farming mm-hmm. and to continue to be a part of sustainable ag advocacy through my position at Southern SOG. I feel truly blessed.
Okay. So as you were walking your very impressive path, how did you get to Southern SOG and take the executive director position?
Well, that is a very good question. And it has sort of a practical nature to it in the sense that when I chose to leave academia so that I could be at the farm and managing it, you know, directly. It's tough to farm these days without off-farm income. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're in a very remote area. I am speaking to you via the internet, via the hotspot on my phone. We can't even get cable internet access where we are. Mm-hmm. And I would be talking to you today through a satellite access to internet, but it's very cloudy. Mm-hmm. And a bit rainy today. Mm-hmm. So the satellite is not the most trustworthy during these circumstances. But anyway, the point being that jobs are also very limited in this area. And if I were to go sort of the traditional route, say, of continuing with research in the private sector, I would need to drive more than an hour, hour and a half every day one way to the Cincinnati area. Mm-hmm. And that's not a sustainable life in my view. And so I became very curious about the opportunities for working remotely. And as I opened up my head and my heart to that possibility, there was an advertisement for Southern SOG Executive Director, which is a remote position. The entire staff, well, the executive director and the executive assistant, and then the board, we all live in different states. So it's a virtual office. And that worked that was a model that would work very, very well for me. So I interviewed, and the rest is history. Here I am.
Well, welcome. We're glad to have you. And it's interesting, Carol, because just when you're describing your path to where you are right now, you mentioned some interesting things. One is when people think about sustainable and talk about sustainable agriculture, a lot of times, you know, in my work, a lot of people automatically it's organic, and organic is a part of sustainability, but it's not what sustainability is. And a couple of things that you mentioned, for example, broadband access to decent internet is becoming more and more a feature of, and is actually lack of it is actually an impediment in many of our rural communities to keeping those communities sustainable. So it's interesting to hear you talk about that and define how that informs you and the work that you do. So, but what do you, when people say sustainable agriculture to you, what comes to your mind? What do you think sustainable agriculture is?
How long do you have, Brandon?
Yes, I know that's a loaded question. So.
Well, right. So I'll give you the point of view from Southern SOG, and then I can give you, you know, my point of view. So for Southern SOG, we're talking about a broad spectrum of practices from, as you mentioned, you know, certified organic, can be, you know, fairly large farm focused, maybe only on livestock, down to, say, an acre of ground by that maybe somebody who recently was an Iraq vet has an opportunity to work an acre of land and has never farmed before, but is interested in doing things that help preserve and build, say, soil fertility, to have a crop of, say, you know, squash and greens to sell at the farmer's market. So, you know, all along that spectrum, from very, very small to mid-size, but the focus for Southern SOG is food, not commodities. Mm-hmm. So then me personally, Carol Williams, talking about sustainability, I would take that a step further and say that there is also ways to look at commodity production that would protect and improve soil fertility, for example, and also protect our water and wildlife resources. So, you know, going back to earlier in our conversation with my introduction, you know, I came to agriculture looking at very, very large pieces of the earth's surface, landscapes of, you know, tens to hundreds of thousands of acres. So sustainability on an acre farm, for example, somebody who's producing for their local farmer's market, versus maybe farms in Iowa that are producing grain commodities to, say, very, very large orchards in eastern Washington state. Really what we're talking about is achieving multiple goals simultaneously. And that is production. First of all, producing something, food, feed, fiber, fuel, in ways that are profitable for that farm enterprise, while maintaining or hopefully improving all of the components of those ecosystems, the agroecology at the places of productivity or production, and also while protecting and enhancing our other resources, water, wildlife, climate, atmosphere, all of those things, so that we are not only protecting what we already have, we are building and improving upon it. So for me, there is no difference between sustainable agriculture and a new term. It's not really new, but it's gaining a lot of more visibility these days, regenerative agriculture. Mm-hmm. To me, they are the same thing.
Okay.
I think that folks that use the word regenerative agriculture somehow hold in their mind that sustainable ag is sustaining some baseline or sustaining some level of something, whether it's soil fertility or water quality. But I think those of us that have been in the game for quite a while, like the founders of Southern SOG and the other SOGs, probably argue that at the heart and soul of sustainable ag has always been the building up and the improving over time, and very much the frame of view that folks today use when they say regenerative agriculture.
Yeah. And, unfortunately, like a lot of things, we get into buzzwords. So you keep hearing that term regenerative agriculture now, but, I just really wonder how many people understand what that means, or is it becoming a new organic where people sort of infringing on the space that say, or organic ag did, and then it becomes a marketing ploy. So, I'm really glad you guys looked at the conference schedule, and I'm really glad that you guys are really making that step to sort of educate people about what regenerative agriculture is and how it ties into things like climate change. What do you grow on your farm?
Well, right now I grow chestnuts, Chinese chestnuts. Oh. We established our first acre, well, it's a little more than an acre, what was an old corn and tobacco field. We have a lot of steep topography here, so there's really only a little bit of bottomlands and then some narrow ridge tops on this farm. Otherwise, it's typical, Kentucky hill farming.
Gotcha.
So the hillsides have all been retired and are, for about the past 35, 40 years, have been come up in forest. But as my cousin was an absentee farmer, an absentee owner, she allowed some neighboring farmers to rent and basically just let their cows loose in the woods, as folks tend to do. But we all know what happens with rented land. It's like a rented car. Mm-hmm. Nothing accelerates faster, turns sharper, stops quicker, than a rented car.
Yeah.
And rented lands are the same way. They get opened up to some abuse. So there was a lot of corn on corn on corn and tobacco on those ridgetops. So my husband and I took over ownership of the farm on Earth Day in 2015.
Okay.
And on that very same day, we asked the farmers that were renting and raising corn after corn to, no, thank you. We will not be renewing that contract. We had the fields limed and shortly thereafter sowed with some high quality perennial hay. And into that, we have planted our Chinese chestnut orchards.
Okay.
And then from there, our next steps will be, we're looking for some form of livestock, goats or lambs, to manage in some intensive rotational grazing to make use of some of the hillsides, but in ways that are much more friendly to the erodible soils and some of the unique ecology that we have around here, and to protect the waterways, keep livestock out of the waterways, those sorts of things.
Yeah. So, yeah. What day is Earth Day?
Oh, April. It's usually April 22nd, isn't it?
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So we purposely chose that as our closing date on the farm, Earth Day, because it was very symbolic to us.
Yes. Good. Good. Yeah, you always got to have that connection. I'll always remember 2015. It didn't happen on Earth Day, but my wife and I were attending a business meeting in Virginia, and we went to go see her mom, who lives in Virginia, and she was only a couple hours away. So we said, we'll make the trip to go over there. And we had just gotten to her house. I mean, I just had enough time to take a beer out of the cooler and pop the, open it up when we got a call, and our house was burning to the ground. So,
oh no.
2015 will always be a watershed for me, August 5th. And that sort of brings me to a segue that I want to talk to you about, because in terms of regenerative agriculture, there's also the whole issue of resiliency. And we in the South here have been hammered by just natural disaster after natural disaster after natural disaster. Mm-hmm. North Carolina, Texas, Louisiana, there's been flooding, there's been hurricane. Southwest Georgia, no one even talks about the damage that happened after Hurricane Michael. You know, $2.5 billion in damage. And it's a type of damage, you know, a little farmer like me who grows leafy greens and stuff, I can rebound the next year. It's easy enough for me to plant. But down in South Georgia, you had pecan orchards. You had large stands, timber, pine. They grow a lot of pine down there. And I was talking to someone, I don't know if you know Don Cooper, but Don Cooper was saying that he talks to a lot of farmers down there. He just said, I got to get out because I can't wait 15 or 20 years for me to start to realize a profit from it. And I think that's one of the values and the great things that Southern Sog helps with farmers, because we can start to look at these trends. And I think you guys have a couple of climate. Don't you have a couple of climate sessions at the conference this year?
Yeah. Well, I, Brendan, I'm so glad that you mentioned this about the resiliency and how important resiliency is to be able to continue to farm or to begin to farm in the face of a changing climate where extremes of weather happen more and more often. And that also, meanwhile, in just sort of social and economic terms in our country, there's very little support to the farmer to help with that resiliency outside of the Midwest and outside of commodity farming. And as we all know, you know, there are subsidies for crop insurance, but that crop insurance and the subsidy is often driven by standards with regard to cropping rotations. So even if, say, there was a large commodity farmer that has insurance, wants to put in, say, cover crops, they run the risk of losing, you know, that crop insurance. And so, you know, even those sorts of things are not available to the smaller farmer. So I want to tell you and your listeners about something that's I've become more and more aware of. Back in October, I attended a conference at the farm of Caney Fork Farms. It was hosted by former Vice President Al Gore. And this conference was called the Climate Underground Conference. And it was an invite situation with some of the world's leading climate scientists, soil scientists, community organizers with regard to food access, healthy food, healthy communities, and built around the notion of regenerative agriculture being a part of the solution that takes carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, puts it in the soil as carbon through agricultural practices and a variety of new and emerging cropping systems and approaches to agriculture. And then through helping to bait climate change, build resiliency into farms, you know, how to, from year to year, weather the extremes, pun intended, even though it's not funny, it's not a laughing matter. And one of the things that struck me at this conference, hearing leading scientists around the world, community organizers, policymakers, leading policymakers, is that the quest for solutions to climate change tend to be focused on very large farms and commodity farms, because a couple of things are driving that. One is we have a huge problem on our hands. There's a huge excess of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So an expedient way would be to say, where are the most acres that we can get new practices and a whole bunch of carbon sequestered right away? So of course, everyone looks to the Midwest, for example, where average farm size is what now, 500, 600 acres. Mm-hmm. And you can deal with basically one farm manager to get to those 500, 600 acres. That a lot of the opportunity in the South for carbon sequestration, carbon farming, and building resiliency into those farms. Again, the South is being overlooked. Mm-hmm. And also part of the problem is something that you mentioned earlier, technology, access to broadband. Technology is gaining more and more importance in the restoration agriculture with regard to surveillance. In other words, satellite imagery, use of drones, smart tractors, things like this that can be used in computationally intensive modeling so that you can prove, for example, how much carbon you're sequestering and get that certified so that you could then sell that carbon. Yeah, that's tough because I don't know about you, Brennan, but I can't afford that technology.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And a lot of people can't have access to broadband.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I have some ability to connect to you, you know, today, but I'll go through my data limits here real quick if I had to rely on an intensive amount of data gathering.
Mm-hmm.
And keeping all those records, keeping records, good records, verifiable records, that sort of carbon accounting on any individual farm is a skill in and of itself. And adds another burden to the workload, the daily workload. Mm-hmm. So I am very interested in making it my responsibility in leadership at Southern SOG is to continue to press policymakers, business leaders, community organizers to continue to reflect on the situation in the South as the reality of the South.
Mm-hmm.
These weather extremes and the need for resiliency and the needs of the people in the South, mm-hmm. rural, small communities.
Mm-hmm.
Number one, we need to have access to the internet in all of the ways that people in cities do, so that more people can be on the farm and not have to commute an hour, hour and a half one way each day to get the needed off-farm income.
Mm-hmm.
And so that they can join in some of the carbon sequestration solutions by access to some of the data that's being gathered through surveillance technology and satellites and things of this nature, and online trainings to be able to work with researchers and agribusiness leaders that are forming, for example, carbon markets, that the farmers are part of these systems that get built to monitor, trade, to monetize, to track, to verify that all those things that regenerative agriculture, sustainable agriculture can be done without leaving the small farmers, particularly farmers in the South, yeah. on the wayside.
Yes, 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 yes.
I know I said a lot.
Yes, 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 but it was all right on point. It's funny, I was either talking to someone or I was reading an article, but one line had struck me, is that the person said that you can really tell how disconnected a community is from the rest of the larger society is if you drive through the downtown and you still see video rental stores. And you know, at first I didn't get it, but then all of a sudden, yeah, they can't access Netflix. They can't access Amazon Prime. They can't do any of that stuff. And I was having a conversation with Mrs. Shirley Sherrod, who runs up the Southwest Georgia Project. And she said one of her biggest challenges, and she has plenty of land, plenty of opportunities, what is keeping young people in these rural areas. You know, they want to get to the big city to take advantage of things like the internet and all goes on with it. One of the people on your program that I was very glad to see and who I'm starting to work pretty closely with is Scott Marlowe from Rafi. And he and I have had these conversations. One, we're trying to do some work together around farmer stressors and farmer suicide prevention. But Scott has a unique, and I think he's giving this talk at the conference about why farms fail, and that Scott presents a theory that, you know, we're probably training these young farmers the wrong way. And for as much as we like to talk up and be positive about small-scale sustainable agriculture, you know, we've got to ask the difficult questions like, are these farmers actually making money? You know, are they able to support themselves? Are they coming to it where they've got enough cash flow they could support themselves and their families? And so I'm really going to be interested to hear Scott's updated take on this whole thing. But I just wanted to get your feelings about that. It's like urban ag. My farm sits outside. I'm 30 minutes from Hartsfield-Jackson Airport in Atlanta. I'm 30 miles. And I was a big proponent of urban ag quite some time. And I'm actually quite disappointed with a lot of folks in the urban ag movement now, because I personally never thought urban ag was going to feed the world. I think it has its applications to help address some areas of food insecurity in some neighborhoods. But I really saw urban ag as being the gateway to connect with some of these rural communities, to get farmers' products into these larger, more lucrative urban markets. And that, at least in Georgia, that hasn't happened. I don't know if you've seen it happen in other areas of the South, but I'd like to hear your opinions about that, whether you're seeing this urban-rural divide actually being successfully addressed in some other states. Because here in Georgia, we're just not getting it done. I'm just going to be quite honest with you. But have you seen where folks are actually addressing this issue about the divide between rural communities and urban communities, and especially as it applies to farmers in rural communities and getting their food into, outside of the commodity supply chain, getting their food into urban markets and getting a better price for their products?
Thank you for that question, Brennan. This is a very complex area of not just food production, but everything that you mentioned, just the social disconnect between urban and rural areas, and how we just as humans, as naturally, we sort of divide the world up into things that, you remember when we were kids, you would have a puzzle in front of you with different things that were pictured, and you always got to ask the question, which one of these things doesn't belong? You know, it's kind of like we've been trained in our minds from the time we're very early to look for things that are similar or something that's different. In many ways, that's a very helpful analytical tool to have as a human being. But sometimes it works against us. We create sort of false differences. Or they may be differences, but we treat them in ways that are not the differences we treat as in ways that are not helpful. And that urban-rural differentiation, I think, is something of a difference that we need to continue to sort of soften that boundary, if you will, in our minds. And one of the ways that folks seek to do that is to build through farmers markets, for example, in addition to urban agriculture, farmers markets where folks from the outlying rural areas come to the farmers market. People have an opportunity to meet the farmers. A lot of farmers markets offer some sort of social space, usually with children-friendly activities. Maybe a couple of the vendors are preparing foods that can be eaten and consumed there to create a space for people to interact. So I think that's one way that a lot of work is being done to try to put urban areas and more rural areas and softening the boundary, and softening that boundary particularly around food. Now, with urban farming, I think, yeah, that's a little different, because in some areas we have food deserts, the so-called food deserts, where there just is no access to food. literally people would have to drive, if they could drive, if they have a way to drive or city bus or you know, something, distances to get to any kind of food, let alone, you know, healthy food. And so, you know, we see places like in Atlanta and then to our neighbors up north in Detroit, where there's been areas that have been converted, areas that have been abandoned, buildings raised, and then those lands opened up for settlement, so to speak, like, you know, folks did, you know, 100, 150 years ago. And to some places have been more successful at that and others have not. I don't know enough about whether or not there is anything in common. You know, I'm sure our rural sociology and our agricultural sociology friends in academia probably could speak to this better, Brennan. But what I want to say is that I don't have access to the information. I haven't really asked myself the question, though, if I want to be completely honest, to say, what is it in common? Is there anything in common among these pockets of where urban ag has been successful? And as you say, folks can actually make a living at it. What help did they get? Is there a common thread there in terms of city policy, access to land, whether or not they were given access to the land as an owner of that land, or, you know, what rental agreements, and then what help have they had or not in terms of marketing and pricing? You know, there's a certain amount of experience, I guess, that you get when you're really able to put a value to your labor. I mean, we can all say how much seed costs. Mm-hmm. We can also say, if I hired labor, I paid labor at X and, you know, X dollars an hour. But I think we all have problems putting a value to our own labor. Mm-hmm. And so my view, what I keep hearing from young and new farmers, not just in urban areas, but everywhere, is that they undervalue their own labor. And so the biggest challenge, as it has always been, I think, is the cost of producing something and then the price that you really need to be charging to be profitable versus what is the price that your customer can afford. And so, again, it has to be one of those things where, is there something in common, too, with our food access policies and programs like SNAP and, mm-hmm. and other public supports to help with that gap between what folks can afford to buy versus what the farmer can afford, right. what price they can afford to right. sell at. Right. So my thought is that it's probably in those two things, the oh. access to land, what is the price of access to land, mm-hmm. and what sort of support is being given to the gap between what the price that the farmer can afford to sell at mm-hmm. versus the price that the consumers at that location can afford to buy.
Yeah. We could probably do a whole show about the merits of cheap food or disadvantages of cheap food. Yes, cheap food is cheap, but that brings along its own problems, you know?
That's right.
You know, and we don't talk about that enough. So before we leave, I just want to talk about the conference because you guys put on an awesome conference.
Yeah.
So this year's conference is going to be January 22nd through 25th at 2020 in Little Rock, Arkansas. And it looks like your overall theme is agricultural resilience in a changing climate. So how'd you guys come up? Was this already decided when you came aboard, or is this something you had some hand in shaping? And let's sell your conference because it's an absolutely amazing conference. And I always tell people that's our flagship conference if you're in the Southeast. So.
Well, thank you for mentioning that and speaking those kind words about our conference. Yeah, so January 22nd to 25th in 2020 in Little Rock, and the annual conference has a title each year: Practical Tools and Solutions for Sustaining Family Farms, mm-hmm. and has a very rigorous 2-day schedule of concurrent sessions, a plenary speaker as always, and pre-conference activities, field trips and workshops, day-long trainings and half-day trainings. Mm-hmm. And when I came on at the end of June, I thought, well, I think anybody who is familiar with Southern SOG's annual conference has come to expect this, mm-hmm. this great diversity of things. Mm-hmm. But that maybe for newcomers, or a way to raise awareness among people perhaps who have not attended in the past, is to every year highlight a special topic. Mm-hmm. And so this coming conference, the 2020 conference, I decided to do something new. Mm-hmm. And you see that in the conference brochure, there's like a blue ribbon across there that says special topic. Mm-hmm. And as you mentioned, agricultural resilience in a changing climate. So we came upon that that topic, specifically climate change and how we can create resilience in agriculture through sustainable ag practices, or what some people might also refer to as regenerative agriculture, because it's so immediate. The need is so immediate for the reasons you mentioned earlier, that folks in southern Georgia and North Carolina and elsewhere affected by hurricanes and other extreme events, mm-hmm. of weather. I have to say that on my own farm, within the last 2 years, we have experienced two new meteorological phenomena because of anthropogenic carbon dioxide, excess carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So human caused too much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has so radically changed the physics of the atmosphere that we now have two never before seen observed meteorological phenomena. One you've probably heard of, a rain bomb. You've probably heard that.
No, I haven't heard of that.
And the other is called flash drought. And rain bombs are, you might have heard the word microburst, where mm-hmm. they're a sudden, unpredictable downdraft from a thunderstorm, or maybe not associated with a thunderstorm. But a rain bomb is a very wet downburst. Mm-hmm. So in the matter of an hour or 2 hours, you might have 8-10 inches of rain.
Wow.
At a location. Wow. On the other extreme is what's called flash drought. And a flash drought happens unpredictably and very quickly because the atmosphere has increased ability to evaporate soil moisture, mm-hmm. compared to previous periods of human history. And in the case of flash drought, it can happen very suddenly, even after a period of soil moisture surplus. So you can go from a surplus, you know, perfectly normal or even slightly surplus in your soil moisture, to suddenly drought conditions.
Wow.
Like in a flash, so wow. to speak. Mm-hmm. And on my farm, in 2 years, we have experienced both of those things.
Wow.
And so how can we build more resiliency into the farm in terms of, well, if we're going to continue to feed people food, we have to have crops and cropping systems mm-hmm. that can withstand those sorts of extremes, or we have to have enough diversity on our farms in terms of food production that if one of our crops is not productive because of weather extreme, others are.
Right.
So it became sort of personal for me in terms of climate change. And then we looked through our potential list of speakers and folks who had expressed interest in participating in the 2020 conference. And so many of them were related to resiliency and climate change. So we made that our special topic for the upcoming 2020 conference.
And I just noticed when I see all the blue dots now, I really didn't pay attention to it. But yeah, now that I see it, it's all... You have agriculture and climate change, policy imperatives and opportunities with my good friend Sarah Heckney with NSAP. Heifer Ranch, regenerative grazing systems, and good local management for livestock production. And you have climate change, resilience, and the future of food with Laura Legnett, who's written a lot on this subject.
So, yeah.
I'm really looking forward to the conference this year. What I want to close with, Carol, and I really appreciate your time, is the importance. I know a lot of nonprofit organizations that does good work like Southern SOG, and I also know that each year it's almost like Sisyphus pushing that rock uphill. The financial challenges that nonprofits like yours face. So if you can talk a little bit about that and talk about how important it is for people to, even if it's $5 or $10 or $15, to support your organization and the work that you do, because I think a lot of people just think that the federal government just hands out money for you guys to do this. And I don't think you get any federal funding as far as putting on this conference. It's really a true grassroots operation. But how important it is for people to support it, if you can't, to help get farmers to these events and stuff. So if you can talk a little bit about that and let our listeners know about the challenges that you undertake, that you face in trying to put on to do this good work, I'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Brennan. That is a very important question. As you've said, the work of nonprofits, all nonprofits in our society serve a very, very important role. That is, what government units can't do or don't want to do, or the electorate doesn't want them to do, and that, you know, the for-profit world can't do or is not interested in doing, then, as you say, we have to do ourselves, in this case, at a grassroots level. And nothing happens for free. There's no free lunch. So yeah, you have to find the funding for these things to get the work done. And in our case, a conference comes with certain costs, cost of the venue. We have a team of people that help put it together. And they're not in a position to do things on a volunteer basis. Mm-hmm. And I believe people should be paid for the time. And, you know, there is a special place in heaven for volunteers. Mm-hmm. And we do rely on volunteers with the conference because it is a huge endeavor. Mm-hmm. But I believe that most people should be compensated for their work, especially when their expertise and their skills are more than just a few hours a month. It's part of life and livelihood that they should be compensated. And so, yeah, what we do, our portfolio of fund getting and fundraising involves sponsorships. People, companies actually provide sponsorships. Folks participate in the trade show. Of course, there's a small fee that they get for that. Mm-hmm. Registration, there's a fee associated with it, but we keep it minimal so that we can serve the people we intend to serve. Mm-hmm. But we like to think that people are more likely to attend the conference when they also have some skin in the game, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So we don't have any problems ideologically mm-hmm. with having a fee associated with that. We do want to keep it minimal. So we do seek sponsorships from like Farm Credit and other commercial enterprises. And also the NRCS yes. Provides us with that a few $1,000s every year for that. Meanwhile, we do have a couple of USDA grants for programs outside of the conference. So we have, you'll see on our website, the Growing Farm Profits project, where there is some record keeping training called Veggie Compass, and the other one's mm-hmm. called Livestock Compass, to help improve your profitability by tracking your costs and where your income is coming from, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, again, that's a small portion of our overall annual operating budget. In today's era of so much work that nonprofits have to do, and also government grants becoming more and more lucrative. What I mean by that is the amount of grants being given through USDA, for example, whether it's through SARE, Southern SARE, and NEFA and other programs, you know, budgets are tight for federal government as well. Mm-hmm. So those grants are becoming more and more limited. And we're finding, however, that the needs, particularly at our land grant institutions, mm-hmm. Of all stripes, depend on a lot of those grants for their research and their outreach. And we find ourselves at Southern SARE, for example, as competitors at times mm-hmm. with our peers and our partners and our colleagues for those same dollars. Mm. So one of the things that we're doing at Southern SOG is looking to slightly modify our funding portfolio to include supportive foundations.
Okay.
So that's one of the things that is now on my desk, is looking for those in the philanthropic world, whether it's family foundations, corporate foundations, but those partners, the good relationships, the good match with folks in the philanthropic world that know, understand, and value not just the work of Southern SOG, but more importantly, the work and the values of our constituents, and that is farmers. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Farmers and those community organizers that seek to connect farmers and the food that they produce with people that consume good, healthy food or that need to consume good and healthy food. So going back to something we were talking about earlier about sometimes those boundaries that we draw in our minds, mm-hmm. like the one that's not necessarily a good boundary sociologically for all of us to say there's such a clear divide between urban and rural. I think that there's a lot of room for foundations mm-hmm. to help build those bridges between rural and urban areas by connecting those values that our farmers have of producing good, healthy food mm-hmm. in strong, resilient systems so that farmers can survive and thrive, and so that people in urban areas, suburban areas, and in small rural communities can have access to good, healthy food and good connections with their rural farmers and food providers. Might sound idealistic, but I think a more verdant and peaceful world is in the offing as a result.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Well, thank you, Carol. I want to thank you for spending some time for me. So once again, the Southern SOG Annual Conference will be held in Little Rock, Arkansas, January 22nd through 25th. There's still time to register, right?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yes, go online. You can register. Mm-hmm. And we will have some volunteer opportunities coming up.
Mm-hmm.
Reduced if you sign up to volunteer. Okay. And then after you have worked your volunteer shift, you become eligible to apply for a further rebate to your registration. Okay. So that's a huge opportunity. And we'll have more on that online in about the next 2 weeks.
Okay. Well, I will be there with bells on. I'm looking forward to meeting you in person. And I'm going to do a little live podcasting from the event because I have so many friends who are going to stuff just talking about the
awesome. Oh, that's so exciting. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But I want to thank you for taking this day after Thanksgiving to speak with me. And I'll have all your information in the show notes to the Sustainable Ag Writer podcast. And I want to thank you so much. And you thank Keith and Julia and all the other folks who do your board for all the great work that you guys do on a year-to-year basis. So I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Brennan. This was a lot of fun. Okay. I really appreciate the opportunity. And all our best to you and best wishes for you and your farming in the coming year.
Yes, I've actually been off the road for a while. So Sustainable Ag Writer has actually not been riding anywhere. My wife got a hip replacement about a month ago. So I just took some time off to make sure I was with her to take her to her physical therapy and just be here. But I'm anxious to get back out. So see you in January.
Thank you for listening to the Sustainable Ag Writer podcast. Please visit our website at sustainableagwriter.com, where you can subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. If you found value in this show, we'd appreciate a rating on iTunes. Please tell your friends and colleagues about the show and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Once again, thank you for listening to the Sustainable Ag Writer podcast, sustainable ag news and views.